All right. So grab a Bible and we're going to read the story in Exodus chapter 2. We're kind of doing this series in you know, kind of big chunks. And our big theme here is trying to point us to how Exodus connects us to the story of God. If you read Exodus, in fact, this morning we are actually going to read through probably the part of the story that is most well known, that movie makers who have made love to spend most of the movie on the story that is contained in Exodus chapter 2, telling the story of Moses, this guy who shows up in the book of Exodus, his early life, his birth, his early life, and the things that lead up to God using him. And so we're going to read this passage together, but really Moses is not the center of the story. And even this passage makes it clear that the real hero is the God who is going to be our rescuer, our redeemer, the one who is going to step into the story of people and to act on their behalf as he is in a relationship with them. And so grab that, page 39 and 40 in our Bibles if you have that, or you got it in the app. We're just going to read the story this morning, and then we're going to try to unpack what's going on so that we can go out of here and have a big view of God, maybe a small view of ourselves, and place our faith and hope in the right place. So it says, "Now a man from the house of Levi went and took a wife, a Levite woman." Now, before we get too far into this morning and read the story, you got to know what's happened, like what we covered last week if you weren't here, or if you haven't read it, chapter 1. What has taken place already is that we have learned that there is this group of people that are called the Hebrews, the Israelites, the Jewish people, who are descendants of this one guy named Abraham, whom God has chosen. His purpose for choosing Abraham was to initiate his rescue plan, to form a people. God's plan in the Bible, his purpose in the Bible, is that he has created us in his image. We are fallen, we have rebelled, we are broken, and God's rescue mission is that God is going to redeem a people. That is always his plan. We're going to see the template or the model for how he does that in the book of Exodus, but that is his plan for you and for me. God's purpose, his plan, is to redeem, to rescue a people for his glory, and when we are the rescued people for our good, so we become people who see the beauty, the awe, the glory of our God, and now we understand that is shown through the face of Christ. And so what happens is that God is rescuing a people, and as he rescues us, our lives are for his glory, for his splendor, for his beauty. And so he does it in such a way that we don't take the credit. That's why we sing "Love Shines." Because we know, God, it is your love that shines into our hearts at Calvary that has changed us. And so what's happened in the story is that God's people spent 400 years in Egypt, and during that time, the Egyptians, for their own economy, for their own power, for their own might, had turned the Hebrews into slaves. Horrible, wicked slavery, massive oppression, massive injustice. But that wasn't good enough. Now they feared, Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, feared that the Jews would become so mighty in number that if anybody ever attacked Egypt, they would side with the attackers and would overthrow the Egyptians. And so out of fear, they begin to do genocide. They begin to kill the Hebrew babies. And in fact, chapter 1 ends with an edict from Pharaoh that when a Hebrew woman has a baby, if it's a girl, let her live. If it's a boy, we are to cast that boy into the Nile River and let him die. That's very interesting. There's a couple thoughts here. First of all, why let the girls live? Why not all babies? And the truth of the matter is that there is a double injustice planned here. We're going to kill the boys. We're going to use the girls. And so Pharaoh's edict is just wicked and horrible and broken. We're going to find out as we go this morning that this story is not that far from the way the world really operates. And so out of this edict, the last verse in chapter 1 is this edict to kill all the babies. And out of this, we have a Levite woman, a Levite man having a baby boy. And now we have a dilemma. We have a problem because that baby is in peril from its birth. And it says, "The woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was a fine child, She hid him for 3 months, and when she could hide him no longer, she took for him a basket made of bulrushes and daubed it with bitumen and pitch, and she put the child in it and placed it among the reeds by the riverbank. And his sister stood at a distance to know what would be done to him. Now the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river while her young women walked beside the river. She saw the basket among the reeds, and she sent her servant woman. And she took it, and when she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby was crying. And she took pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrew children." Then the sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call a nurse for the Hebrew woman to nurse the child for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." So the girl went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. And when the child grew older, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she named him Moses because, she said, "I drew him out of the water." Now, just feel the story. Like when we read narratives in the Bible, as you're reading the Bible and you get to the story, it's really easy for me. Like I'm a heady dude. Like I think, I'm a thinker. I'm not first and foremost a feeler. And so I'm always grabbing the big books and finding out what the theologians want to tell us about this. And sometimes I skip over the fact that stories are written, first of all, to draw us in and help us feel. This is a true story, but the story wants us to identify in the story with what's going on. It wants us to feel this. So feel what's going on as this mom and this dad have this child in the midst of a situation where the baby is in peril from its birth. Feel the weight of a mother sitting in a room and trying to hold that baby and a 3-month-old baby crying as mom is saying, "Please don't cry, please don't cry, please don't cry. Shh, they're right outside the door, please don't cry." Feel the weight of the father doing everything he can to keep distance between the people who were sent by the Egyptians and the mother and the baby. Feel the little girl who's the sister and the brother. We find out later that Moses has an older brother who's about 3 years old now. And the fact that they would draw attention to the fact that there's another baby in the household. I mean, feel the weight of the moment. And what we find here is that Moses is rescued out of this, but the text also wants us to feel the weight of all the babies that were not. God, like there is grace here, but there is a lot of brokenness going on around them. And the weight of this is very heavy. And all of a sudden, this woman is hiding this baby, and she comes up with this plan. And Hebrews 11 says this plan came out of her faith, that she was not willing to give herself to the plan of a wicked king, and she would face any cost, but life mattered to her. And so she took the baby and came up with this crazy plan. She puts it in a basket, or they take a basket, they make it out of bulrushes, that, you know, a reed, they just kind of weave it together and make a basket. They put tar and pitch all on the inside of the basket. They probably put some kind of, you know, crib-like feel, you know, softness, because stick a baby on tar wouldn't be okay. But then they take this down to the Nile River, and they theoretically obey the command. They put the baby in the river, right? And that now the baby is in this basket floating in the river. Text doesn't tell us if it floated downstream or if it was just in a bay, or we don't know. We know that the Nile River in certain times of year was just prone to flooding, getting out of its banks and filling, and there would be all kinds of backwaters. We just don't know. But what happens in the midst of the story, as this mom and this dad and little brother and little sister are fretting, and little sister we know is now watching this event, out of in the middle of this, here comes, it just so happens. It catch that. It just so happens that at that moment, Pharaoh's daughter comes down to take a bath. Now, why bathe in the Nile? I mean, like you and I going, "Hey, it's bath time. Let's go to the Mississippi River and hang out," right? That's not the first thing we think, except this week in the Hubbard House, we might have. Our hot water heater went out on Monday, and I thought about taking a shower on Wednesday. Like, by Wednesday, I was like, "All right, I probably need to do this." I turned on the water, let it run for about 40 seconds, thinking that it would run the colder water out. I was wrong. The warmest water was when I first turned it on. I put my hand in that water and went, "Nope, not today." And so all this week until Friday, we have a membership of the Timbers, and we just kept sneaking different family members down to the timbers just to take showers this week, okay? That was our week. So here's Pharaoh's daughter coming down, taking a bath in a river. But what's going on here? There's so much more than just the fact that she is going to wash. This is important to us this morning, because this morning we are going to have a celebration. We want to invite you to hang out. Our service is not going to end with the last song. We're going to go to the pool, the swimming pool at Eureka High School. We're going to baptize some people. And it is their declaration of their faith in the one true God who has saved them, right? It's going to be a great morning. This is her baptism. This is her coming to the Nile, which they saw as divine, and immersing herself into the Spirit River, right? And she's going to bathe herself. And in the midst of doing this, it just so happens she sees the basket. And as she sees the basket, she hears the baby crying, she picks it up, and here's what's really, clear in the story. She immediately notices this is a Hebrew baby, but decides that she is going to care for it as her own. And here she is looking around going, what do I do with this? I haven't recently had a baby. I can't nurse this baby, per se. And all of a sudden, here's Moses' older sister going, hey, you want me to find you a nurse? Now, understand, there are women who are capable nurses everywhere in Egypt among the Hebrews right now, because there's a lot of mamas who had babies whose babies have died. So on one hand, we rejoice in the beauty of the story of this mother who gets to nurse her own baby and get paid for it. That's great. Weep for the mothers who don't. Be broken for the crying in Egypt that's going on. But God is up to something. God is doing something. And we say, why doesn't God just stop in and stop this? Because the answer, now here's the big theological answer. The world is a deeply broken place. It shows us how far away from God this world is and how desperately we all need this rescue. And so, Pharaoh's daughter goes, that would be great. Find me a nurse. Well, Miriam goes back to her own mom. And now mom and dad, they get to raise their little boy for a season. And all we know is that when he's a little bit older, he ends up in the palace of Pharaoh. We don't know if he keeps going back. We just don't know. I talked a lot last week about the recent movie. I'm not going to do this, but a whole lot today. But the recent movie pictures Moses is not knowing his heritage. And that just doesn't stand the weight of the text. Moses knows where he came from, but he also knows that now we have this young man who's been raised in two cultures. He has this Hebrew heritage that comes from his birth and his early life, but he's also raised in the household of Pharaoh, under Pharaoh's daughter. We don't have any idea how many kids there were in the family. We don't know how many daughters Pharaoh had. But the bottom line is we have this Hebrew kid raised in the household of Pharaoh, and now he is going to get educated in the right way. He's going to be fed. He's going to be treated like one of the king's kids. And here is Moses growing up in this household. But something changes when he gets old. There is a drastic change. So we pick it up here. It says, one day, when Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and he looked on their burdens and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. Now, in the text, this is one of these places where I wish the translators would have come a little closer to the word. It's not just one of his people, it's one of his brothers, his people. What we find right here is Moses is now old and he is choosing to identify himself with the Hebrews. This is the author of Hebrews, the New Testament book of Hebrews, telling us that by faith, Moses chose the scorn of being with the Hebrew people rather than living in the luxury of the palace. This is Moses at this point in time going, I don't want to end my story as a mummy, right? He's in line with these mummy stories. In fact, a few years ago, we went to the art museum. In the art museum here in St. Louis, a lot of fun. There's a lot of, it's fun on two levels. There are a lot of pictures that, for me, are worthy of being made fun of. I'm just saying. Now, I get that is my lack of culture, looking at some of this stuff, going, my daughter, my six-year-old, made something that looks just like that. How'd that end up here? I don't get that, but a lot of people see that, and they're, the deeper meaning, and for those of you who are artsy, woohoo! Me, I didn't get it, okay? I just think some of the stuff in there is just bizarre. There is also some incredibly beautiful, moving places all through the art museum where the art just transcends, you know, just this deep beauty, and you are drawn into it. But the other thing is there's this room in the basement where they have this whole Egyptian room, and they actually have two mummies that are this era. And this is Moses at this moment going, that could be my story. 3,000 years from now, I could be in a museum in St. Louis. And Moses at this point identifies and says, here are my people. And he identifies with the Hebrews, but something really weird happens as he does this. It says, he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people, and he looked this way and he looked that, and seeing no one, he struck down the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. In other words, he killed him. He has now murdered an Egyptian. And when he went out the next day, behold, two Hebrews were struggling together. And he said to the man in the wrong, why do you strike your companion? And he answered, who made you a prince and judge over us? If you ever, like one of the movies is called The Prince of Egypt, you want to know where that text comes from? It's right here. Who made you the prince? Who made you the judge? Are you really the prince of Egypt over us? Do you mean to kill me and as you killed the Egyptian? And so what's going on now is first, he sees an Egyptian beating up a Hebrew, and he's going to rescue this Hebrew. He kills the Egyptian, and thinking nobody saw him, he just buries the guy in the sand. But the next day, he sees two Hebrews fighting. He gets in between them, tells them to break it up, and now the one of them, the one who's in the wrong, who's kind of bullying the other guy, goes, who made you the king? Are you to kill me like you killed the Egyptian? And what now Moses now realizes is that he is known, that what he did the day before is now going to leave him in peril. He's being rejected by the Hebrews, and he knows he's in danger of the king. It says, then Moses was afraid and thought, surely the thing is known. And when Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and stayed in the land of Midian. And he sat down by a well. And now we have this man who was raised in the palace and under the leadership of Pharaoh, running from Pharaoh. And now he is out in the desert, out in the wilderness, in the land of Midian, a long way away. It's not a short trip here. It is a long journey. And he's just hanging out in a place that basically is nowhere. Now the priests of Midian had seven daughters. And they came and drew water and filled the troughs and watered their father's flock. And the shepherds came and drove them away. But Moses stood up and saved them. And he watered their flock. There's something in the heart of Moses that knows his mission. And now he is rescuing these women from this band of marauders who are trying to run the women away and say, you know, you're not allowed to water your sheep here. And he kind of takes their place. And Moses jumps up and runs them off and gives these women the opportunity to water their flocks. And it says, when they came home to their father, Reuel, he said, how is it that you have come home so soon today? And they said, an Egyptian delivered us out of the land of the shepherds and even drew water for us and watered the flock. And he said to his daughters, Then where is he? Why have you left this man? Call him that he may eat bread. And Moses was content to dwell with the man, and he gave Moses his daughter Zipporah, and she gave birth to a son, and he called the name Gershom, for he said, I have been a sojourner in a foreign land. And so here we have, what we have is we have Moses out in the wilderness, and later in the text it tells us this is not a short period of time. For 40 years, Moses is going to live out in Midian, out in the nowhere land, as a nobody. The once prince of Egypt is now living in a place where he has no reputation, he is not known, he is alone, he ends up rescuing these women, and he ends up living in a household with this guy who here is called Reuel. Later we find out his name is Jethro. And personally, if I'd have been called Jethro or Reuel, I'd have stuck with Reuel, right? But he is now in this house, and because of this, he ends up with a wife, he ends up with a family, he ends up having a kid, but he is now here for 40 years. This is not short. This is a long period of his life. This is Moses, who on the inside of him has some sense of mission, some sense that God, my whole story is wrapped up in the fact that I was a Hebrew who should have died. But as a Hebrew who should have died, I now have been rescued and I grew up in this place. There's got to be a reason. God, you have to have a purpose for this. There has to be a reason. This has to make sense somehow. He rises up and kills a guy and then thinks that he can rally the Hebrews around him, and they reject him. He realizes what he has done has been found out by Pharaoh, and now he has fled, and for 40 years he lives in nothingness, just looking up at the stars, trying to make sense of his life. Has a family, has a son, but is watching sheep. No place. No place for somebody who grew up like he did. And what happens is, in the midst of this, and the storyteller, Moses is telling this story, the storyteller Moses, who's writing this for us, is not telling us stuff randomly. Because the next few verses are the key to understanding everything in Exodus. Watch this. Here's what happens. It says, during those many days, the king of Egypt died. In other words, what we find out right away is, God, who is the author of life and death, is acting, and the king has died. The one who Moses would have feared going back to no longer is in power. And the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. Both of these words are only used in the context of prayer. They are groaning and crying out to their God. And it says, their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God, and God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob, and God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. One of the things that we like to do is, I spent 20 years in youth ministry, and we've repeated this with our family, is we go on mission trips or we go on trips where we went south. And one of the things that I've been intentional with both my family, with groups of people, is that when we head south in America, we're going to stop at places that tell us about what happened in our country. I've taken my kids and youth groups to the Birmingham Civil Rights District, the 16th Avenue Baptist Church, which ought to just, for me, walking through that church was just, it was a defining moment. As I walked through this church where in 1963, four redneck good old boys set off a bomb on the edge of this African-American church and killed four little girls who were in their Sunday school class. And those men, most of them never met justice. It wasn't until just the last couple years where one of them finally did. Right across the street from this is this park where at one point in time, police and firemen into a group of peaceful protesters opened up fire hoses on little kids. And right across the street from that is the Birmingham Civil Rights Museum. As you walk through and you see the story of what happened in our country, beginning with slave ships that came here and the whole story of the civil rights from slavery through the Civil War and all the way up to the present and the different people who've been part of that. And I took my family to Memphis, and we went to the National Civil Rights Museum, which is in the Lorraine Motel. They have turned the motel where Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated into a national museum telling this story. And walking through this, I just shuddered to see what happens in humanity where we just begin to justify ourselves, but we want to exalt our own cause, the lengths that we as people will go, leading to injustice and brokenness and horrible things. I sat on the bus in there where Rosa Parks sat. It's in the museum. It's an amazing thing. And then walked by a bus that was part of the Freedom Riders that actually got bombed. Saw pictures of lynchings. And every time I've walked through one of these, my heart just groans and aches, hating that was at one point in time part of our story. Injustice is a crazy thing in our world. And we think that if we just rally the right people and say the right things and get the right people together, we will end injustice. But what happens is everywhere we think we've got a handle on it, the handle often creates other issues. But greater than that, everywhere we get a handle on it, something over here springs up. And so here we are in a world where ISIS is doing what they're doing. And we have what happened in Paris this week. And on one hand, we see the tragedy in Paris, and we're just like crazed by the fact that in Western culture something like this could happen. But at the same time, I saw a tweet this week that said, in the time since the people died in Paris, which is a tragedy, at least 2,000 people have lost their lives to the same sort of issue in the Middle East, and we don't even know about that. And we read story in Exodus here of babies being killed, and we go, this doesn't really happen in our world, except right now in China, it is illegal to have more than one baby. And so by the millions, baby girls are thrown into the sea now. And there is a story of one family who tried to sneak through this, and because they would not abort the baby, had a saline solution given to the mother that was supposed to kill the baby in childbirth. The baby did not die. There became this legal struggle, but in the middle of the legal struggle over the next couple days, in front of the parents, to make an example of them, they put them in a room where they could not get free, and they drowned the baby right in front of them. Exodus is still going on. The story of brokenness and injustice in our world is still a very real thing. And what happens is when we are in a culture that is doing fairly well, it just feels like something that's way out there, that it's at arm's length. And one of the things that Exodus is going to show us is that God cares about the brokenness and injustice in the world. But the other thing that Exodus is going to show us is that the problem runs really deep. The problem with us and our humanity is not just a minor thing that if we just get a weekend away with the right counselor, we can solve this. It runs really deep. And therefore, the solution to this problem has to run really, really deep. And we live in a world where we see this stuff going on, and we know there are places in the world where people are crying out and groaning and wailing, and many of them even knowing Christ, knowing God, many people who are Christians. In fact, a lot of the people in the Middle East who are dying right now at the hands of the Muslim extremists are dying because they are followers of Jesus. And we say, where's God? Why doesn't he step in and rescue? Why doesn't he just act right now? And it feels like God is silent. And then we read Exodus here, and what we find out is that Moses' life now, if based on a couple passages, maybe as many as 80 years. In the middle of this story, that's another 80 years that started with 400, where it seems like God has not acted. And then we get to verses 22 and 23, and it says, the groans of God's people cried out to him, and they were lifting their voices, and God, that the prayers, the groans ascended to God. And then this passage that is so rich says, and God heard. See, what's happening is we're beginning to see what's happening is grace. God, who is in a covenant relationship with these people, they are his people. And now God is hearing their prayers. It says God heard their groans. It says God remembered his covenant that he made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. These are their forefathers. God remembered. God saw their suffering, their brokenness. And God knew. God knew. Now we can read this and go, does this mean he didn't know? Did this mean he didn't hear? What's happened? Was God like up in the mountains on a vacation, fly fishing in the stream, and all of a sudden he gets a text that goes, hey man, there's a problem down here, and he comes back and all of a sudden everybody's like, man, all heck's broken loose. He's like, holy cow, I had no idea this was going on. If I'd have known, I'd have been here, I'd have done something. That's not what the text is trying to say. What we have here is language that now is going to show up all over the Bible. As you become a Bible reader, start looking for this language of God hears, God sees, God remembers, God knew, when it's in relation to his people. What's going on here is that their prayers are involved in this, but the God who is at work, who is sovereign, has now come to a point where he is looking at his people and he goes, it's time. It's time. I am going to act. We live in a world where there's all kinds of injustice and brokenness, and we have a really hard time putting together the big picture often, where we see stuff going on in the Middle East, we see stuff going on in China, we see stuff happening in the midst of the world, and we say, where is God? Why is God silent? Why has God not intervened here? And we struggle to see this, and we go, does God even know? Does God even care? Is he out there? Is he involved? And we come to this text, and we hear, God knows, God sees, God hears, and he remembers. And what happens is you study history is we have this amazing ability to look back on these periods and see great revivals come forth, see masses of people who come to faith in Jesus out of moments in history that were really dark. Already in the Middle East, I'm beginning to read that there is, nobody is, like, you don't hear this unless you're reading missiologists. People are writing about missions and about, but already right now in the Middle East, where the suffering is the worst, people are watching how Christians are suffering and going, whatever they have, this God that we're serving doesn't do this for me. And God is rescuing and redeeming his people in the midst of the suffering of the Middle East. In China, out of the midst of persecution, suffering, the church blew up. And so we can look back and go, oh, there it is. But in the middle of it, man, it's hard. And we can see this in our own lives as we're walking through, like, man, I'm one of God's kids, but I can't make sense of all this. And my life just doesn't seem to fit, and it's hard. God, how do I make sense of this? And the thing, I mean, I'm going to backtrack on the story here in just a minute and try to give you a framework to see what's going on in this whole story. But the thing, like, if you don't leave with anything else, just because you don't see God's activity doesn't mean he's not working. But God sees. God hears. God remembers his covenant. He will keep his promises. God knows. And he is going to work in your life for your good and his glory. And so what happens in the story is we get to this point where there are groans. They're like the people are groaning. So here you have Moses over in Midian trying to make sense of his life. And the people who are under this horrible slavery, this infanticide, this craziness that is the brokenness in the world are just like they are going back to their houses and they are crying out to their God going, please act on our behalf. We trust you, but please act. And their prayers mixes with God's sovereign grace to do something. And so here we are at this point in time when Moses is 80. But what the text wants you to understand is that God was already answering their prayer with two Levites who had a baby. You see this? He was already acting to accomplish this purpose. And what happens in the Bible is God lays out his story, because what God is doing is God is telling us his story. He is showing us how he rescues, how he redeems, how he acts, and what God always does in the Old Testament. It's an amazing, amazing thing. And this is, but what God always does in the Old Testament is that when God is about to act, when God sees and hears and remembers and he knows, and now it's like it's time, the first thing God does is God steps into the life of a person. God is going to redeem and rescue his people, but God raises up a person who is going to be the deliverer. And the people are the most uncanny people. It's most of the time it's people, you would never choose this guy. You would never choose this person to be the person who's going to be the leader of the people. But often that's the point of the story. Often as the stories are told, we find out about their births, and we find out that there's most of the time nothing extraordinary about the way they're born. Except that it's something miraculous. God did something really cool to bring about their birth. And we find out from the beginning that this person was chosen not when they grew up and became this certain type of person, that God worked in their life and chose them before they were born, and their birth is part of God's activity. But then they grow up and they're all jacked up. They're, like, every last one of them is a mess. But God still works through them, and he keeps rescuing his people through a deliverer. He keeps redeeming. And at the end of every story, nobody goes, man, what a great guy. Nobody looks and says, man, this Samson dude, he is the guy we ought to pursue. We got to be like Samson. This Gideon guy, I mean, he is the ultimate hero. No, what happens when God does the work, people get to the end of the story and go, oh, what a God. Oh, what a God. What a God who redeemed us. He is our redeemer. He is our rescuer. So what God does is he keeps telling his story by raising up a redeemer, using that redeemer, that deliverer, to be the one, the human vehicle who is the mouthpiece for God, that human vehicle who will act and lead the people, but that human person who's kind of the mediator in the story that God uses to accomplish his work, so at the end, God has rescued his people and his people come back to worship. And that story is told over and over again because we see these people and we're like, this guy isn't the real redeemer though. And I mentioned this last week, that the stories whet our appetite for some kind of way that the story is fulfilled in this beautiful, rich finish. And that all leads us to the true Redeemer, who is Christ, who is born with a crazy birth story, who comes out of Egypt just like Moses and the people of God, who goes through hardship and turmoil and even comes to a point where he prays, my God, why have you forsaken me? And God, through Christ, the true Redeemer, is remembering his people. He is hearing, he is redeeming us and rescuing us from a problem that runs really deep. And so what we have in the Moses story here is we have the building of a model that shows how God acts in people's lives. How God redeems, he's going to rescue and redeem Moses, and in turn use Moses to rescue and redeem his people. And there's some beauty in this story, as the story is really, we're finding out the young, early life of Moses, but what we're going to find is that God is orchestrating the events of his life to accomplish in Moses what he needs so that God will use him to bring glory to himself, but God will use him to rescue his people. And so before the people pray, before we have the text that says God knew, God understood, God heard, we have God already at work raising Moses. And there's four things that happen in the story I want to point out to you real quick this morning. Four things that take place in the story that happen in the life of Moses that just really clear about God's work in Moses, that becomes clear in God's work of any rescuer. But it's also true of us, because here's the bottom line. As God works in us, as he saves us, as he rescues and redeems us, he rescues and redeems us to be part of this mission. And we may never, ever lead a nation of people, but God saves us and blesses us to be a blessing. And so here's Moses, and the first thing we find out about Moses is his election, that he was chosen by God. That literally, this is not about Moses, is it about God working in Moses before Moses could even do anything? I mean, we start the story where God is at work, and the fact that in verse 1, and just look down with your eyes, it says a Levite man and a Levite woman come together, and they have a baby. And you and I read that and go, huh? Well, what's that mean? Does that mean they have really cool genes? Is that, you know, some of y'all get that this afternoon. Levi, ba-dum-bumps. I'm sorry, bad joke. We read this and go, what's going on here? But a Hebrew person who read this would have gone, oh, okay, I see what's going on. Because what happens in the biblical story, the story that we've been trying to unpack here, is that God starts with this guy named Abraham and calls him. Abraham has a son. That son has twins. And the one son who is part of God's purpose in the story, Jacob, has 12 sons. Those 12 sons become, their descendants become the 12 tribes of Israel. Everybody in Israel knew not only that they were a Hebrew, but they knew which tribe they came from. But as the story goes forward, what we find out is that the Levites, the tribe of Levi, is special. They are dedicated for a special purpose in God's plan. The Levites are going to be the tribe of priests and religious leaders in Israel. they are going to be the ones that God has set aside to be God's mouthpiece, to be God's spokesperson. And the Levites are going to be the priests and the leaders of the religious life. And so here are two people who are Levite from this tribe who are married, and they have a baby in the midst of this horrible mess. And before anything happens, before Moses does anything good or bad, before Moses has anything to do, what the story is trying to tell us is that God initiated this by bringing two people together and raising up a little baby. And God gave us Moses. And the story of Moses, I mean, we know the destiny of Moses before he's old enough to really leave his mother's side. That God has chosen Moses for this task. And the story begins with the fact that God, who is sovereign, is at work, and it is up to him. Now, the beauty of this in Moses' life and in yours and mine is this, that what makes Moses special is nothing in himself. I mean, what makes, really, if we start the story where it starts here, what makes Moses special? He's just a Hebrew kid born in a horrible situation as a slave. But see, God is at work, and ultimately what is going to make Moses special is not who Moses is, it's whose Moses' God is. And the fact that God is at work in Moses choosing him and bringing him to himself, and what this really tells us is that God is the one who takes the initiative in the story. Now understand that the story of Exodus does not begin with the people groaning or with Moses growing up and going, you know what, God, I want to serve you. The story of God's redemptive plan begins with God taking the initiative in the life of Moses for his people. It is he who takes the initiative. What does that mean for you and for me? Here I am this morning living my life out, and I have, like, God has rescued me. He has saved me. I'm so thankful for that, which means at some point in time I trusted in Christ. But you need to know this, that if you are here this morning, you are a follower of Jesus. You are not a follower of Jesus because you chose Christ first. You are a follower of Jesus because God took the initiative with you. And God is always the one who takes the initiative in our life. He is the one who is pursuing us well before we're pursuing him. He is the one who is at work in our lives well before we even think about following him and trusting him and be used by him. God always takes the initiative. That is a good thing. We are not left here. We may feel alone, but we are not left here alone. We can know that God is the one who has taken the initiative to pursue a relationship with us, and he loves us and he cares for us. But this flows out of this God who is sovereign. We can't make sense of all this, who is at work in the world. He will accomplish his purposes. And he is pursuing us. If you were here this morning and your story is, listen, I didn't grow up in church. I've got this like whole weird background. I don't know what to do with my life. I don't know how to make sense of things. I know that all of a sudden I have this interest in faith, and Jesus is kind of making himself real to me, and I haven't really figured it all out. I haven't really trusted Christ yet, but I'm there. Listen, the whole reason that's taking place in your life is because God is pursuing you. He has taken the initiative by his Spirit. He is working in your life. And therefore, it doesn't depend on you. If you read Exodus 2 as a moralistic tale and somehow make the hero Moses, you're going to say, well, this is all about Moses and the story depends on Moses. And right away, what the story is trying to tell us is this. Nothing in this story rests on Moses' shoulders. It is all the work of God. Moses cannot pull off the plagues. He cannot pull off he can't rescue these people. And so we look in our lives, we're like, man, I'd love to be used by God. I want to figure this faith thing out. How does this work? Understand this, at the end of the day, you don't have to accomplish it. We're just called to look and trust in the God who loves us and who rescues us and pursues us. God takes the initiative. Moses' story begins with this really weird birth. Moses didn't choose how he was born. He didn't choose his parents. He didn't choose the activity of his parents. But God already is telling his story through Moses here. The second thing we find about Moses and how God works is through rescue. Rescue. In verse 2, it has this very interesting thing that happens, right? So here's Moses being born in this time where babies are being thrown in the river. It says, the woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him 3 months, and when she could not hide him no longer, she took him She took for him a basket made of bulrushes and daubed it with bitumen and pitch, and she put the child in it and placed him among the reeds by the riverbank. In other words, we've already talked about this, the fact that Moses' mom made a basket out of reeds, put tar in it, and put him in the river. Except if you were, this is back to where sometimes the translators make it readable in English and they miss this cute, this beautiful little thing. The word for basket here is only used one other time in the whole Bible. Now, where it's used over and over again in one story. But it's used multiple times, and then it's used here, and then in the original language of Hebrew, it doesn't show up anywhere else in the Old Testament. So, the word for basket here is actually the same exact word as the word when God looked at Noah and said, I want you to build me an ark. It doesn't say basket. We know it's a basket because it was made out of reeds, right? But what God said, what the story says, is that she built him an ark. We're supposed to see an ark floating in the water where God is rescuing his people, just like Noah, where God had Noah built an ark. God closed the door. He saved his people. The imagery here is very clear that they are supposed to be thrown in the river. This river is now going to consume Moses. This river is now going to be the doom of Moses. And out of this, God calls his family to build him an ark. And Moses is placed in the ark, and he is rescued from the face of the waters because of the ark. What's going on here? What's the text trying to teach us here? That God is rescuing Moses. And so we have all these people involved in the story, and Moses ends up hearing in the house of Pharaoh, but the story begins here with a baby who should be dead. The story should be over. And he goes into the same waters that everybody else loses their life, but in this story, at this moment, that God has rescued him. And God has orchestrated the events of this story so that, the text is trying to help us see the beauty of God's rescue. What's your story? What's your background? What's your heritage? How does your story get told? The big idea here is that this is what God wants to do. He wants to rescue us out of the pit of despair, out of the brokenness of the world, and out of my own sinfulness. And he has provided a way in the midst of that for me to be redeemed, for me to be rescued. Now, what is going to happen is this Moses who is rescued here is going to be the Redeemer. He's going to be the one that God is going to use to do this for all of his people. But before Moses can be a rescuer, he had to be rescued. He had to have God act on his behalf to do something he couldn't do on his own and provide a vehicle for him to be rescued. The text wants us to see that. This is our story, right? We cannot be involved in the purpose of God until we are rescued. And if you're here this morning and you've never come to the point where you've trusted Christ, today's the day. Just cry out, say, God, rescue me. Save me from myself. Save me from my brokenness. Save me from my sin. Be rescued. The third thing we find out about Moses is not only how does God raise Moses? He raised Moses through election. He raised him through rescue, and then he raised him through ruin. What Moses believes in his head, like what happens when he gets old and he leaves his house and he does identify with his own people, but there is something going on in Moses where he's going, I can do this. I am this special guy. I have this crazy story. I mean, I've been told by everybody how I was found in the reeds and I was in the basket and I got raised in, I mean, that's not random, right? I got raised in Pharaoh's house and I have this great education, but I know I'm a Hebrew. I have this dual background. God has raised me for this. My purpose, I can do this. I am ready to step forward and be the redeemer of God's people. And he shows up and he sees an Egyptian beating up a Hebrew. And he's like, now's the time. And he takes the Hebrew down and he kills him, right? And then the next day, he sees two Hebrew people fighting. He's like, all right, I'm going to step in. I'm going to break this up. They're going to go, Moses, we've been waiting for you. You're the guy we've been hoping for. Where have you been all our lives? And he steps in, he rescues, and he breaks them up, thinking that everybody in Israel is going to go, or everybody, all the Jews are going to look at Moses going, yes, and we're going to have a party. We're going to celebrate, and then we're going to go take those old Egyptians on. We're out of here, right? This is what's going on in Moses' head, except when he does it in his own time, on his own power, it's a disaster. It is an absolute disaster. And this Moses, who had this great plan of being what he actually is being called to be, when he does it on his own, ends up absolutely ruined. He has to run, he has to flee, he has to end up out in the middle of nowhere. And when Moses acts, it ends up in disaster. What we find out is when God acts through Moses, the outcome is the deliverance of his people. But right now, Moses is doing for God what he thought God should have been doing all along. You ever do that? God, you're not coming through for me. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to work this out for you. It never ends up like it's supposed to. This is why our reliance is not on our own wisdom, our own strength, our own abilities. Our reliance is on God, who is sovereign, who is working his purpose, even if I can't see it. And so what God does is God chooses to ruin Moses, because he has to pretty much burn all of Moses out of Moses. A.W. Tozer said this: it's doubtful whether God can truly bless a man greatly until he has hurt him deeply. I need to have me burned out of me. And so what happens often in our lives, these times of darkness, this despair, these moments where we just can't make sense, are the times where God is at work bringing us to the end of ourselves. Because until I come to the end of myself, I will never truly trust Christ. And the last thing God does here is not only ruin, he also brings transformation. And for Moses, this is 40 years in the middle of nowhere. How's God going to change Moses' life? He's going to change Moses' life in the desert of Midian, right? And for 40 years, God seems to be silent as Moses is just sitting on a rock with a shepherd's staff watching a bunch of sheep, raising up a family. But God is working in the life of Moses as he is working in the life of his people, preparing them for what he's going to do, and God changes him. And God is taking Moses out of Moses and he's replacing it with something different. And there's great beauty and grace in that. And see, this is how God is at work. This is how God is at work in you and me. This is how God is at work in the world. If you're one of his followers, what God does is God reaches into our life. He takes the initiative and he rescues us from ourselves. He rescues us to the beauty of Christ. He does this through the power of the gospel. And I come to a cross and I look at a cross and go, I caused this to happen. This is how bad the mess in my life really is. And God rescues me from myself and from the brokenness in the world and leads me to seeing the world in a different way. And I begin to care about the things that God cares about. But I still live my life in such a way that I think I've got a handle on this. I have this. And what God has to do is has to burn me out of me and replace it with something much more beautiful. And often the darkest, hardest places for the follower of Jesus are the places where God is doing the greatest work. And so I hold on, I trust, I believe. Moses can't make sense of his life, but God has heard the groans of his people and he is about to act. And so what do I do with all this? How do I respond to this? Well, the text here is just really beautiful. There's two interesting little clues here that the text is helping us see in this story about how we as God's people should respond to these times in our life where it's hard and living in the world. And the first one is just to cry out to God. Like, this ought to be the posture of God's people nonstop. Sadly, it's not. Sadly, our prayer lives are very shallow for the most part, are very simple, and we are not a people who are prone to deep crying out of God, crying out to God. And therefore, we see very little of the activity of God in our lives because there's very little desperateness for it. A lot of this flows out of the fact that what we really see our lives is, we see our lives as something that we can kind of function, and we need God to kind of wedge in the moments, rather than people who are desperate for the act of God. And so the text telling us, listen, cry out. God hears the cries. Trust in him. Hold on to him. God acts in concert with our prayers. And I don't understand how a sovereign God who has already set his plan in place bends that plan somehow to the prayers of his people, but it's clear that he does. And so we just cry out to God. We pray. We just take our request to him. And so we cry out, but then we also go out. And there's something that's really interesting in this story that is like subtle, but it's all over the text. And once again, as you read the story, the story is told in such a way that the text is supposed to help us see this. And so all of a sudden we see Moses is the great deliverer, right? Here's Moses. He's the hero. He's the guy that's going to go. But one of the things that we need to understand is that there are a whole bunch of small people in the story who rescue Moses. We have two women in the previous chapter who refuse to take the lives of Hebrew kids. We have mother and father of Moses doing this. We have sister of Moses getting involved. We have the Pharaoh's daughter who chooses not to take the life of a Hebrew baby when the command was to do this, and rather chooses to bring him up in her household. We have in this story multiple other people that end up ultimately with this guy named Reuel, aka Jethro, who invites Moses to spend his 40 years in a wilderness in his household. All these people. And so what happens is we get focused on Moses and we think, man, I've got to be a Moses to be used in a plan of God. And that's not the story at all. Christ is redeeming his people. But what he does is he calls us and he changes us. And I may not be a leader of a mass of people, but what God may choose to make me as he does this work in my life of choosing me and pursuing me and saving me and changing me and taking all of me out and putting himself into me is God chooses to do all this, right? What often happens is that we are a place where our story is just a little bitty thing, but we change somebody's life. We're involved in God working in somebody's life, and we have no idea the impact it can make. And so I want to close with the story of a guy whose last name was Kimball, who was just a nobody. He's just a shoe salesman, right? Edward Kimball was a shoe salesman in Chicago who had a young man who worked in his shoe store whose name was Dwight Moody. And he was not only the boss for Dwight Moody in the shoe store, but he also taught Dwight Moody's Sunday school class. But D.L. Moody had not become a follower of Jesus. And so he felt like it was his passion, his call to go. And he spent a few minutes one afternoon, sat down with D.L. Moody, and led D.L. Moody to Christ. He's just a shoe salesman. He's just a nobody. And I won't give you the whole story, but what happens is D.L. Moody became one of the most well-known evangelists in the late 1800s. Thousands of people came to Jesus. He influenced a pastor who started doing some revivals, and in some of those revivals, another guy who was another famous guy, I won't give you all the names, became a follower of Jesus, and he began to go on crusades. As he was doing a crusade at another place, a guy felt passionate about the fact that he should be involved in certain things, and he started this massive number of crusades in Charlotte, North Carolina. And in these crusades, he brought another guy to preach. He brought this guy whose name was Billy Sunday, who was an amazing evangelist. And Billy Sunday's preaching raised up a guy named Mordecai Ham. And Mordecai Ham began to preach in this church and do these meetings in this church. And a group of teenagers in Charlotte, North Carolina chose to sneak into church to make fun of the preacher one night. And as they're making fun, cracking jokes, a 16, 17-year-old tall, lanky kid in that service went from making jokes to having the Holy Spirit of God, who was already pursuing him, break his heart and lead him to faith in Jesus. And that 16-year-old kid was Billy Graham, who has preached the gospel to more people than anybody. And the story of Billy Graham's conversion begins with a nobody named Kimball, who was a shoe salesman. Listen, God's desire is to rescue his people. And when we are a rescued people, we are now part of that story who can be part of this beautiful, wonderful purpose of God as he rescues his people for his glory and for our good. So pray and hang on. The band's going to come up here. We're going to sing to Jesus. And then we're going to go celebrate baptism. We're going to party. It's going to be a great morning. And so we're going to invite you as they head this way to stand with us and to sing to Jesus who does this kind of work in people's lives. Lord, we love you. We praise you. We just ask you this morning to work in us and through us in a great way. Help us to grow and learn from this story and just realize how beautiful your work in our lives really is. And I just pray this morning that I know a lot of us come in here discouraged and in despair and seeing the brokenness in our own lives and the brokenness in the world around us. And some of us this morning are here with really tough stuff happening. Lord, don't let us lose heart. Help us to find great solace in the fact that you hear, you see, you know. You have not forgotten us. Give us hope this morning, Jesus. In your name we pray. Amen.